This is an ABC podcast.
Fechando o ano. Hello, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to the first episode of God Forbid for 2019. And it will be a big year for religion and politics. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, hopes to introduce and campaign on Australia's first ever Commonwealth Religious Discrimination Act. How did we get here? In 2017, Australians responded nearly 2-1 in favour of same-sex marriage. Then the former Prime Minister Turnbull commissioned the Ruddock Review into religious freedom. There were 90 consultations and 15,000 submissions, and the review concluded religious freedom needs more protection in this country. The government kept the report for 7 months. Then the new Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, released it just before Christmas, and he promised to implement its central recommendation, a new Religious Discrimination Act.
There is no more fundamental liberty that any human being has than their fundamental right to decide what they believe or not believe, to have a religious faith or not to have a religious faith. Now, the protections that we intend to introduce, they're not about protecting any religious institution. They're not about protecting any individual religion. In fact, they're not about those religions. It's about protecting Australians' right to believe in what they want to believe.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, himself a Pentecostal Christian, announcing his intention to introduce a Religious Discrimination Act. So, is this about protecting people from religious discrimination or enabling discrimination in the name of religion? Do Australians need protection to believe or not believe, or do we have it already? Different views ahead from our God Forbid panel, but just once more from the Prime Minister, because he says the stakes are so high on this issue that it isn't just about religious discrimination, but potentially religious persecution, the kind that makes many migrants want to come to Australia in the first place.
I remember a conversation I had with one such community in Western Sydney, and they said they left where they came from because of religious persecution in the countries they were leaving. Only now they feel to be potentially facing the same sort of limitations to how they practice their religion in this country. And that made me incredibly sad, that one of the great liberties Australia has always been known for is being curtailed. And I don't think that's something I should allow to stand.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. And now to our God Forbid panel. Dr. Renee Barker lectures in law at the University of Western Australia. She's the author of State and Religion, The Australian Story. And she's also an Anglican who advises the Bunbury Diocese on civil law. From our Perth studio, Renee Barker, welcome to God Forbid.
Thank you for having me.
In our Melbourne studio, we have Luke Beck. He's an Associate Professor of Constitutional Law at Monash University. His latest book is Religious Freedom and the Australian Constitution. He's an atheist, a fellow of the Rationalist Society, and an ambassador for the National Secular Lobby. Luke Beck, welcome to God Forbid.
Thank you for having me.
And in our Sydney studio, we have the Right Reverend Robert Forsyth. For 15 years, the Anglican Bishop of South Sydney, now he's Senior Fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies. His latest research paper, A Test of Maturity, The Liberal Case for Action on Religious Freedom. Robert Forsyth, welcome to God Forbid.
Thanks for having me, James. Great to be here.
So, first of all, a simple question to you all. Is the freedom to have a religious belief or not to, and to live by that belief or disbelief, a fundamental human right? Reverend Forsyth.
Yes.
Dr. Barker?
Yes.
Professor Beck?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's God Forbid for this week.
It'd be nice if it was that simple.
Well, let's look at the follow-up question then. From what the Prime Minister said, Australia has a reputation for religious freedom, one of the freest countries in the world. Is that legally true? Professor Luke Beck.
It's legally true and it's practically true. The Ruddock Report, they looked high and low for actual concrete examples of interference with religious freedom, and the Ruddock panel was unable to find any actual concrete examples of people's religious freedom being interfered with in any meaningful way.
Dr. Renee Barker, your view on this?
I think it's a very subtle question, because from a worldwide perspective, do we have religious freedom from a legal perspective compared to many other countries? Yes. From people's lived experiences? Yes. But there are individual cases, small little niggles that are making that a slightly blurrier yes.
And Reverend Robert Forsyth, do you think it reaches the point that the Prime Minister fears, potentially religious persecution in this country?
That is very much a problem. In places like Pakistan and in the Middle East, there is real persecution. And in China, there may be a situation in this country when, with the overzealous use of anti-discrimination laws and things like that, may interfere with the rights of religious communities to order their affairs such that it threatens their existence. That's theoretically possible.
Dr. Renee Barker, your view on this?
One of the points I'd pick up on that Robert made is that when you compare ourselves to Pakistan, to China, we look very, very, very good. People can walk down the street without any fear that they are going to be pulled off the street by the secret police or anything even vaguely approaching that. But we shouldn't be a race to the bottom. Let's not look at the worst case examples and compare ourselves. Instead, what we should be aiming to do is hold ourselves up as a world leader. How can we really make sure that freedom of religion and all other human rights are protected here to the very best standard? Persecution is the wrong word.
Yes.
I thought it was an unfortunate use of a term by the Prime Minister, because it put the focus in the wrong place.
He did say that people said that to him, that they were worried about
true.
It. But I think his reaction was taking what was a fear and suggesting that it's likely, which I don't think it is at the moment.
Which is very poor leadership on the Prime Minister's part. If people come to the Prime Minister and say, I fear that I'm facing religious persecution on the streets of Australia, proper leadership would be for a Prime Minister or any other political leader to explain, well, no, you don't. What you face in Australia does not come anywhere near religious persecution.
Politicians stoking people's fears for political advantage, who would have thought of it?
Exactly.
I want to give two cheers to the Ruddock Review. One is they got 16,000 submissions, which was a massive amount and shows something about this issue in our society. They then got the report together quickly and did a good job, and they're very eminent people. I think the weakness about it was their very hard-nosed empirical approach, looking for evidence, because those who are concerned that the coming of marriage equality may lead to problems cannot be dealt with by a review that says, well, we see no evidence within 3 months. It's the concern about the trend, and it doesn't solve the question of, is there a dangerous bend going on here that may need to be looked at?
I don't think that's necessarily a very fair characterisation. The premise of those comments seems to be that if gay people are allowed to get married, in other words, if people are allowed to live their lives in a way that they want, that's somehow a threat to somebody else's religious freedom. It's not a threat or a harm to anybody's religious freedom just because somebody else lives their life in a way that you don't like.
I agree entirely. That's not the fear. The fear is people preventing others who conscientiously disagree that that is a way of life that should be lived from being able to exist in the public sphere as communities and institutions. The freedom to get married in itself has no implications. It's those who then want to build around that freedom ways of shutting other people up who are disagreeing with it, and that's the danger.
On RN and via podcast, we are talking religious freedom and the government's intention to pass a new Religious Discrimination Act, perhaps only weeks away. Up next, we'll look at that, plus the relationship between church and state in Australia and beyond. It's God forbid. Elizabeth II is the Queen of England, England's head of state, and the Supreme Governor of the Church of England. Anglicanism is England's established or official religion. In America, the founding father Thomas Jefferson said religion is solely between man and his God, and Jefferson helped build America's famous wall of separation between church and state. So what happened in this country when the six British colonies united to form the Commonwealth of Australia 118 years ago? Renee Barker, what path did we take?
We sort of went halfway between the two. If you look just at the wording of our constitution, you'd assume we went for the American model, the separation of church and state. But we haven't gone for a hardline separation of church and state. We also haven't gone for the UK model, which is an established church. What we've got instead today is a society that's somewhere in the middle. We have a religiously plural society, and there's increasingly so. Governments have responded to that by laws which try and accommodate as many religions as possible. We don't always get it right, and that's why we're having this debate today. But generally speaking, we are a legally, pragmatically plural society in terms of religion.
Luke Beck, what does this section 116 of our Constitution say, and how has the High Court interpreted it?
So Section 116 of the Constitution does four things. It forbids the federal parliament from passing laws that establish any religion, that impose any religious observance, that prohibit the free exercise of any religion, or that impose religious tests for federal public positions. Now, that's quite a comprehensive limitation on the powers of the federal government to interfere with religious freedom in Australia. However, in practice, the High Court has interpreted that provision quite narrowly, and we have not really had very many cases in the High Court where we've actually tested the full extent of what this provision might or might not do in practice. That's not necessarily a bad thing. That might actually just be a reflection of the fact that our politicians in Parliament don't go around trying to pass laws that get involved in religion, which is actually a good thing. But we don't quite know the full meets and bounds of what it means in practice if federal parliament was to try and force people to participate in particular religious practices or, say, ban some other particular religious practices, because our politicians just haven't gone down that route.
Reverend Forsyth, given what we've been hearing, do you support, in principle, the Morrison government's plan to introduce a Religious Discrimination Act?
I'm really in two minds about it, actually. I'm very cautious about anti-discrimination law in all its forms. I know we have to have some of it, but I'm fearful it may cause more trouble than it's worth, and that's the danger with these things, because when you have discrimination acts, you've got to then have exemptions to discrimination acts. And I discriminate on the basis of religion regularly in my church leadership, not elsewhere, who we allow to do this and do that. The Act would therefore have to say that's okay. And so when you have discrimination acts, you've always got to carve out exemptions, which creates the problem we've got now, where because there are exemptions, people get all anxious and we have that moral panic. And the thought is somehow religious organisations or others using the exemptions are getting away with something that otherwise would be illegal. So I'm frankly not that excited about it.
Luke Beck, federally, we have an Age Discrimination Act, a Disability Discrimination Act, a Racial Discrimination Act, and a Sex Discrimination Act. But we don't yet have a National Religious Discrimination Act. Is that the final missing piece in the human rights puzzle?
Perhaps not. The principle is that, number one, nobody should be discriminated against because of their religious beliefs. And secondly, and equally, nobody should be allowed to use their religious beliefs as a license to discriminate against others. So, sure, let's have a federal Religious Discrimination Act like we have bans on religious discrimination in most states. But let's make sure we don't use that act to allow people to discriminate against other people because they have some sort of religious motivation for treating other people poorly. So, should we have a Religious Discrimination Act? Well, it depends on what it says.
And Renee Barker, we haven't seen the precise drafting, but the government has given an indication that it will broadly conform to existing discrimination legislation. Do you support a Religious Discrimination Act?
I do, as a Religious Discrimination Act, modelled on the Racial Discrimination Act. And one of the reasons I think that is at the moment when we talk about religion and discrimination, we're always talking about exemptions. Religions are getting an exemption. Religions are getting special treatment. Religions are being allowed to behave in a way that would otherwise be illegal if they weren't religions. And I think having a Religious Discrimination Act will flip that. Rather than what the focus is today in the discussion with religion is on the right of religious people or religious organisations, more precisely, to discriminate. And I think that's an unfortunate negative understanding about freedom of religion and discrimination involving religions. So I think it would be a very good idea.
On RN and via podcast, it's God Forbid, we are talking the freedom to believe and not to believe and where we'll all stand if the government's Religious Discrimination Act comes into law. We're with Dr. Renee Barker, a law lecturer from the University of Western Australia, the author of the new book State and Religion, The Australian Story. Also Associate Professor of Constitutional Law Luke Beck from Monash University, his latest book, Religious Freedom and the Australian Constitution, and the Right Reverend Robert Forsyth, Senior Fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies. Renee Barker, Australians are becoming less religious at a rapid rate, and our views about gender and sexuality and morality have been transformed in all of our lifetimes. What does this mean for religious freedom?
What it means is we need to be careful and go steady, steady. It is very tempting that when things are changing rapidly, to change the law rapidly to fit with what's happening and to throw out things we don't think we need at the moment. Marie Kondo's Netflix show Tidying Up has sort of swept the internet with this craze of people throwing out things that no longer spark them joy. And I can certainly think of a few Australian laws I'd like to see thrown out because they do not spark me joy. Religions have a lot to atone for in the way in which they have treated LGBTI people and their families and supporters. But in making sure our laws don't continue to perpetuate marginalisation, discrimination against these individuals. We need to make sure we don't at the same time swing too far the other way.
Robert Forsyth, you recently wrote that identity politics is weaponising victimhood and grievance. A minority is determined to take offence at slights perceived more than real and use the pulpit of outrage to impose a new and intolerant orthodoxy.
That's the danger.
Could that criticism be levelled at you?
I hope not. It's very important that we have good faith in this battle.
You're a conservative Christian an increasingly irreligious country, and you're outraged that your views on marriage and morality and sexuality are shared by a small minority that's getting smaller. Don't you consider yourself a victim in this? Your identity in identity politics,
well,
you're the victim.
Yes, but I suppose so. But I'm not going to go out trying to use the law to stop people criticising me or thinking I'm an idiot, or saying I'm an idiot. If they want to say that, they can. The trouble we've got is this, James. There's been a sexual revolution in the last 50 years, and particularly with marriage equality, that's kind of brought to a very important moment. But there remains in the society, and will remain, I think, forever in the society, what I call recalcitrant minorities.
Irreconcilable difference that will not be resolved.
Away. Absolutely, not go away. There's no way it's going to go away. My own religion, the Christian religion, we had this fight with the Romans and the Greeks when we started on these very issues, in matter of fact, and we maintained a distinctive Christian ethic about marriage and sex to this day. And there's no reason if another 2,000 years last, we're not going to change. And therefore, we've got to find how can we live as a mature society with those irreconcilable differences in a way that really is good for everybody. And that, I think, is the great challenge. Not weaponising laws, finding a peace together. That's the need now. We've had the marriage equality war, if you want to say it. Now we've got to find out how to make the peace long term, not winner takes all.
Luke Beck, where do you see the balance being drawn between the two?
I think there's an element of unreality. Nobody is giving any actual concrete examples. In Australia, discrimination on the ground of religion is already unlawful in most states and has been unlawful for some decades.
But not all.
Not all. And that's a gap that needs to be filled. But of course, as Ruddock pointed out, there are very few, if indeed any, cases of religious discrimination actually happening. The second point is that just because there are gay people and there are trans people, etc., there have always been gay people, there have always been trans people since day dot. Just because they're now coming out of the closet and no longer hiding who they are, that doesn't mean that other people's religious freedom is being interfered with. Just because somebody else exists in a way that you don't like, frankly, that's not any of your business.
I agree entirely. That's not the problem. That's not the issue. We religious people have the fear that if we teach what we believe to be true, we'll be accused and then legislated against.
So we should pass the law in response to your fear rather than any actual problem.
What Archbishop Porteous got into trouble with in Tasmania, he sent out a letter to his diocese spelling out the Catholic view of marriage, which one person thought was demeaning to her particular sexuality, and took him to a tribunal. Right,
that's not a real case. That was a vexatious complaint that was withdrawn because it had no merit.
Perhaps if I could interject here, the problem with that case is, no, it wasn't a case. It didn't go anywhere. The complaint was withdrawn. But it was costly. It was time-consuming. It was distressing for both sides to be involved. And part of the problem here was, I don't think anyone really fully understood what the law was. The Catholic parties didn't know whether what they had done was okay. They thought it was. The party bringing the complaint didn't fully comprehend if what they did was okay. But if you ask somebody on the street, do we have freedom of religion, they're most likely to quote me the First Amendment of the American Constitution. There's a lack of understanding about what that actually means in the Australian context. But also, to give a concrete example, the federal parliament, the Senate, passed rules, not law, a rule that temporarily restricted the wearing of facial coverings in their gallery, in response to a rumour that somebody was going to protest about wearing facial coverings. And in the process, they discriminated against a group of women who were already marginalised by excluding them from viewing the parliamentary process legally.
Yes, correct. And the Attorney General himself cited that example, Christian Porter. He said that was an open and shut case of religious discrimination in the federal parliament. That's now legal, which he wants to make illegal by way of his Religious Discrimination Act. And he cited other examples. Have a listen to those and then we'll come back for some comment.
We've got examples of Baptist care organisations in Queensland putting a view to their staff about how people should view marriage, just in the same way that Qantas did to its staff. And yet that Baptist Care Organisation executives are brought into proceedings at law in Queensland. There are examples of people having Facebook conversations with their work colleagues where they put a view in favour of traditional marriage being sacked. So this offers those people the same protection that they would have if that discrimination had occurred based on their race or their sex or their gender.
Luke Beck, does the Attorney General make a case?
Well, if somebody has been sacked because they express a religious view, then that's obviously wrong. And in most states, that's already unlawful.
So, Luke, in federal law, we have a suite of anti-discrimination acts. Religious organisations are exempt from some of them. How does that work?
So, generally speaking, a religious organisation, so this is not a private individual who happens to be religious, but a religious organisation such as a church or a religious charity or a church-run school or a church-run hospital, for example, they are generally speaking exempt from all of the federal anti-discrimination rules if the conduct they wish to engage in conforms to their religious beliefs, principles, or tenets. But there's an exception. There is no exemption whatsoever in aged care. If you are a religious-run nursing home, you cannot discriminate against your residents or patients, regardless of what your religious beliefs are.
But you can in schools and charities.
But you can in schools and charities, provided that it conforms to your religious beliefs or principles. And then there's a big but. Just because it might be allowed under federal law, it might, depending on what state you're in, be unlawful under state law.
And Luke, the Greens want those exemptions for religious organisations removed from our federal discrimination laws. You're a rank and file member of the Labor Party. What's Bill Shorten's position on this?
Well, I can't speak for the Labor Party. The Labor Party will speak for themselves. At the moment, there's a bill before the federal parliament introduced by the Labor Party that would remove exemptions in the case of schools, including religious schools, and essentially put schools in the same situation as nursing homes. So schools would not be allowed to discriminate against students in the same way that nursing homes are not allowed to discriminate against residents or patients. But just like nursing homes are allowed to discriminate against their staff if it conforms to the organisation's religious beliefs. And the Labor bill would continue to allow schools, including religious schools, to discriminate against their staff if that conforms to the religious beliefs of the organisation.
So Robert Forsyth, yep. What that means in practice is a religious school can sack a teacher for being in a de facto relationship, can refuse to hire another teacher for being gay, and can do the same to a teacher who might get divorced.
If it conforms to the doctrine of that religion and religious sensibilities. Yes, look, most religious schools are not religious. I mean, they're church schools in a vague or sense. I call it the homeopathic method, just a little touch of something on the edge. And maybe they're concerned about their chaplain, but there are some schools which I call intentional religious communities where the parents and the organisation, the school, want to run not just an education institution, but a particular kind of intentional religious educational institution. For the law to say, for a member of the staff of that school to not walk the walk of the religion of that school in major ways would be inconsistent with the purpose of that school. And that's why I think it is right they've got the right to discipline or not hire those whose behaviour and beliefs is inconsistent with the particular purposes of that intentional religious school. Even if you think they're rubbish and it's all nonsense, I still think they need to have the right to do that for their own sake.
Luke Beck?
Sure. So the position Robert just describes would be the effect of the legislation that's currently been introduced by the Federal Labor Party.
Do you support that?
Personally, no. And well, it's yes and no. My view is if you are running a school with public money, you should comply with public rules. If you're running a school with your own private money, well, then sure, do what you like.
Well, every private school gets some public money.
I've got a different view on that. Schools are going to be the hot point because schools are the intersection of family, state, religion. I make a distinction between two different kinds of government funding. If the government funds a religious institution to do some work on behalf of the government, run an employment service or something, the government can set the terms of those as much as it likes. As long as it doesn't impose rules upon the religious organisation that would threaten the religious nature of the organisation. But on the other hand, if the government is funding in order to allow diversity, not just provide a service, then the government ought not to be making the funds under conditions that would destroy the diversity. With education, the purpose of funding education is also to allow a diverse range of schools And that's a different kind of purpose than just doing a government business being outsourced to a religious organisation.
When the religious schools are still required to comply with all the formalities of the state and federal-based curriculums. So the idea that there is this huge diversity in the nature of education being provided isn't the same.
No, I'm not
the,
saying.
Their students sit the same HSC and VCE. Religious schools should be treated in the same way as religious nursing homes, that they should not be allowed to discriminate against their patients or students. And I don't think that religious-run nursing homes or schools that are operating with public funding, and in most cases almost entirely with public funding, should be allowed to discriminate against their staff either.
If that was true, for many of them it would destroy their nature as a religious school or institution, because by doing that, you take away the one point in which they can select staff according to the mores of their religion.
If they could source their own funding to run that sort of school, then good luck to them.
But
the public shouldn't be subsidising.
But this is our political view, which says the government should never fund religious organisations. That's effectively what you said.
Dr. Renee Barker, your view on this?
This debate is not new. And ultimately, it comes down to that question, do we want religious organisations, religious institutions, to be funded by the government at all? Because if the answer is no, then obviously we remove any money from any of them. But if the answer is yes, we can't say yes, but you can't be a religion.
I think that's right. It's going to be one or the other, I think. That's the distinction.
We already provide money to religious schools on conditions. We give money to religious schools on condition that the money is used only for education, that the school is not run for profit, that the school conforms to the state and national curriculums. Money to religious schools, it already comes with conditions.
No, Luke, the question is not the question of no conditions. No one's arguing that. That's a straw man. The question is conditions which would threaten the religious nature of the school. That's the problem.
Well, curriculum could threaten the religious nature of the school.
In which case the school shouldn't exist. If school wants to teach something which is contrary to science, I agree that they won't be able to exist.
So why is the school compelled to agree by a curriculum, but not social and legal norms with respect to the hiring and firing of staff who happen to get divorced?
By the way, that's a straw man too.
Well, it's not a straw man for the divorced teacher
they
who's
don't
been sacked.
Where? Who? Speak, it can
speak,
be done.
Speak to the Independent Education Union. They'll give you examples of members.
But the question is, are you going to impose a particular view of sexuality and sexual behaviour upon publicly funded institutions in the society? That's the question.
And Luke, should we or not?
We should prohibit discrimination being subsidised by the taxpayer.
Which is the same as imposing the sexual revolution on all government-funded institutions.
Luke, imposing the sexual revolution?
It's not a sexual revolution. Gay people, trans people have existed since day dot. There's nothing new about that.
That's not the point I'm making. Not where they exist. It's about whether sexual behaviour is morally approved or not. That's the question.
So it's okay to be gay as long as you don't have sex?
I'm saying position? That is what many religions happen to hold who don't believe marriage equality actually is marriage. That's the minority view which is going to be held for a long, long, long time in this society by significant religious communities.
And let them hold that view.
The question is, will you allow them to receive any funding for their schools as religious schools?
Discrimination should not be subsidised by the taxpayer.
No, that's begging the question. That's begging selection.
The trouble selection with the word, is a euphemism for discrimination.
And discrimination is a euphemism to imply that any discrimination is automatically wrong. They're loaded words. That's one of our problems. Selection good, discrimination bad. They both could be the same event seen from different points of view. We're using a phrase called persuasive definition, where you define the question to get your answer.
Marriage equality being a case in point, as distinct from...
Exactly. I've used it out of respect, but I think
discrimination is the term used in the legislation, so that's why I'm using the term. That's the legal terminology.
It's more than that.
Using legal terminology.
On our end, it's God forbid. Up next, something we can finally agree on. Well, we'll see. We're with Renee Barker, Robert Forsyth and Luke Beck discussing the freedom to believe and not to believe and how they intersect. Up next, is Australia a secular country and why the PM Scott Morrison says we are not? When Prime Minister Scott Morrison made his first speech to Parliament 11 years ago, he said Australia is not a secular country. He said we have freedom of religion, but not freedom from religion. You are free to be secular, he said, but that's just one belief system among many, with no greater claim than any other. Well, the National Secular Lobby disagrees with him completely. Their co-director is Brian Morris, the founder of Plain Reason and co-author of Sacred to Secular, Why a Corrupted Christianity Demands a Secular Solution. I spoke to him from our Adelaide studio.
Well, I'd have to say that is really something of a distortion. the comment by Scott Morrison. I mean, becoming a secular nation is not just some arbitrary belief. It's really all about inclusive democracy. Secular countries are neutral to all beliefs, and they don't impose any religious beliefs on the general public. And probably the best example of that, of course, are the Nordic countries, Sweden, Denmark, Norway. And we have the alternative to all of that. The extreme opposite, of course, is theocracy, and I'm sure nobody really contemplates that.
In fact, you say Australia is becoming a soft theocracy. What do you mean by that?
Well, we do, and it's really fairly self-evident insofar as Australia is one of the most Christianised parliaments in the Western world. Only 12% of Australians attend church on a regular basis, but 25% for federal MPs and senators who regularly attend the fortnightly parliamentary prayers.
But if we elect religious MPs and senators, it's democratic to have those views reflected in the outcome.
Well, it's double the Australian average. So, look, and some of the comments made by parliamentarians, and of course Scott Morrison himself in Parliament only a year or so ago was trumpeting that he was on a crusade to protect Christianity. And he's not the only one. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that you expect from democratic secular parliaments.
But how exactly, again, if Australians elect Christians, then they elect Christians. And in the same-sex marriage debate, Australians wanted same-sex marriage. Then in response, that parliament, with its Christians, voted to change the Marriage Act to allow same-sex marriage. Isn't that a secular democracy working?
Well, it's not really when you consider what really happened from that. The then Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, encouraged his parliamentary colleagues to pass the same-sex marriage bill based on the fact that he would then implement the Ruddock Review to look at religious freedom. And it's really from there, the torturous process that we've then have with Philip Ruddock then producing these 20 recommendations. The original report wasn't released for, you know, almost a year. And now we have introduced, or we're going to have introduced into Parliament, presumably sometime after February this year, this new Religious Discrimination Act.
Is that a bad thing, to protect the freedom to be religious or to be not religious, a protection that doesn't currently exist in a standalone piece of federal law?
There are no laws in Australia that limit the right to religious freedom anyway.
But it's not about limiting the ability of governments to discriminate. Isn't it about limiting the ability of people to discriminate, a protection that does not fully exist across Australia? It's a patchwork collection of protections.
We don't know what the entire bill is. It seems that from the Ruddock recommendations that it will also codify all the exemptions for religious organisations to, in fact, discriminate against LGBTI people, against people who don't hold their same religious belief in a whole range of religious institutions, religious private schools, hospitals, welfare organisations and what have you. In the 21st century, it's just not on. It's unconscionable.
If you want politicians to leave their religion at home when they go to work, and I mean politicians in the broadest sense, players in the public sphere, wouldn't that in a way be like asking Martin Luther King to keep his Christianity private, or Archbishop Desmond Tutu, when their faith was in fact the driving force behind them changing the world for the good?
The problem here is that other countries, the Scandinavian countries don't really find they have a need to proselytise in Parliament. Now, I don't see there's any reason why we can't do the same, but it's not just these evangelicals quoting ancient beliefs from the Old Testament about gays and abortion and against voluntary euthanasia. It's a way that incites a lot of bitter Christian activism, people that demonstrate outside abortion clinics, really incited by a lot of the right-wing Christians in Parliament. There was an Ipsos poll that showed that 78% of Australians wanted the full separation of church and state. And within that 78%, there's an awful lot of Christians who want the country to be secular, which currently we're not. As I say, we are a soft theocracy.
And that's Brian Morris, the co-director of the National national secular lobby. Well, Dr. Renee Barker, do you agree Australia is a soft theocracy, not a secular country?
No. I'm not sure he and I were reading the same religious freedom review, to be honest. We use the word Australia is secular as if everyone understands we're on the same page. And he quoted a statistic, 70%+ of Australia want a separation of church and state. And I think, again, it depends, what do you mean by that? The noted Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor outlines multiple different versions of what it means to be secular. So the first, secularism means the complete removal of God from the public sphere. And I think that's what Brian Morris means, that you remove it completely. It's not allowed in the public sphere, as you would see, say, in France. Have we got that sort of secularism in Australia? No. We can all cite examples of our political leaders, our laws, our state institutions having some religious influence. Okay, we've not got that version. The other option is there might be a significant proportion of the population who have no religion, yet the institutions are still nominally religious. We're not quite there yet. We're still over 50% of the population is Christian and well over 50 with a religion. But the third version is that religion and non-religion are just one of many options for the state and its people. Religion is not removed entirely. It is just one voice in the public sphere. It is not privileged. It is not given any special characteristics, and nor are non-religious beliefs, atheism, humanism, agnosticism, and the many variants of that. It is one voice among many, and I think that's where we are. We're far from being a soft theocracy. Far from it.
In fact, listening to Mr. Morris, he wants a soft totalitarianism. His argument seems to be, this is 2019, therefore, religious people should have no say in anything. They should keep quiet and not be involved in any debate whatsoever. Now, that's an absurd view. Let them have their role in the normal political, social issue. Listen to them or don't listen to them. Let's have freedom for them. By the way, he's got a very odd view about Scandinavia. Do you know that in Denmark and Sweden, there is a church tax? That is collected in, I think, Denmark, the government pays more money to the church than gathered by the church tax. It's a very strange situation. They're secular in the sense of they don't seem to be very actively religious, but they are majority members of the state church and pay money for its services. Things are not quite as simple as they look at a distance.
Luke Beck, what's your vision of secularism?
Well, Renee is right. So the word secularism is one of those words that can mean wildly different things depending on who's using the word. So I think it's better to be a bit more precise rather than use these broad, almost meaningless labels. So, and Scott Morrison and Mr. Morris there were obviously using the word secular to mean very, very different things. If you have a religious view and that leads to political consequences and you think, you know, you have a religious view and therefore the law should change to reflect X, Y, or Z, of course you should be allowed to express that view and argue your point in the marketplace of ideas. Same way if somebody has particular, I don't know, animal liberationist worldview or philosophy, they should be allowed to advocate for their views. You know, it's the marketplace of ideas and the democratic process will sort out who wins and who loses in the ordinary way. That's free speech. But equally, you shouldn't try to impose your religion on other people.
And Luke, is that happening in this country?
Not to a very great extent, but there are isolated instances where religion is imposed on people. And Parliament is a very good example of this. Every single sitting day starts with an Anglican prayer. It's compulsory.
Robert Forsyth, is that anachronistic in the 21st century?
It is an historical remembrance of what we Anglicans call the good old days when we were established. If it went, I wouldn't be that unhappy about that. The last thing a truly religious person wants is to make people religious by some sort of sleight of hand. And how many people actually mean that prayer anyway?
Exactly.
For me, it's a very trivial matter. I'm interested in freedom of religion and freedom to be free from religion. People should have the freedom to renounce religions safely. That's the kind of country we need to be in, a country without fear.
So the federal government has supported 15 of the Ruddock Review's 20 recommendations into enhancing religious freedom, but 5 of the inquiry's recommendations were deferred to the Law Reform Commission for yet another inquiry, which will last until well after the next election. Renee Barker, what are the important of these recommendations and what do you make of their deferral?
So the 5 recommendations primarily relate to exemptions in the various discrimination acts, and particularly in relation to schools. For me, the most important of them is the requirement for transparency, and I'm on the record in other places saying that I think transparency in the use of exemptions is really, really important. The key to a lot of the anti-discrimination exemptions is around the necessary for to protect the religious susceptibility of adherents. That's a really fluffy phrase, and unfortunately, we can't do much better legally. But what it basically means is you can discriminate or have an exemption from the discrimination laws if you need to for religious reasons. The problem, however, is when you're a third party, you approach that religion for employment, or you approach the school for employment, or you try to enroll your child, you may know nothing about their particular religious susceptibilities. And so people are going in blind. If we're going to continue to allow exemptions, and I would suggest that some are going to continue to be necessary in order to protect freedom of religion, people, I think, have the right to know in advance that these are going to be applied to them. And so the Ruddock Review, in two of their recommendations in relation to schools, one for staff and contractors and one for students, although the students' ones may become irrelevant, but that the schools have to have a published policy that is available to teachers or to potential staff so that they know whether or not they may face legal discrimination at that school on the basis of a characteristic that they personally have, and the nature of how they're going to do that. Are these provisions going to be hard to get just right? Yes, and that's why I think referring this very complex area off to the Australian Law Reform Commission is a good idea. Bit disappointing that we can't have an answer right now, and frustrating for those of us who are constantly running submissions to multiple inquiries at the moment. But it's important we get this right, and I think transparency, being aware of what the law says, being aware that it might be applied to you, is going to strike at least some kind of balance that we don't currently have. So a lot of the distress after the leaking of the Ruddock Review was because people went, well, I didn't know that law exists. The Ruddock Review is saying there should be a new law. I don't want to be discriminated against. What they didn't realise was that law is not new.
That was an example of the corrupt political process which has surrounded the Ruddock Review, which I think has been very unfortunate. I think the whole review itself was, I guess, political to start with. But the way it was held back and then leaked, and then the, I think, disreputable behaviour of the press in, what was the heading I saw? Secret plan to throw at gay kids, completely misleading, led to a kind of moral panic, then led to the ALP rapidly calling to repeal the very law they themselves had enacted in 2014 in haste. And the danger is, even with the one about students, there may be unintended consequences. So I'm very sorry that the way it's been handled, I think, will lead ultimately to almost no good outcomes. I'm quite pessimistic about the situation, even though I, with you, Renee, I think that greater transparency is what should be owed by those bodies and institutions who have the privilege of selecting their own people certain ways that others don't have. They should be upfront about it. I mean, I am in favour of that. But that got lost in the debate.
I would agree with you. The leaking and reporting was in such a way that immediately the whole Ruddock Review has now been tainted with this negativity around these particular issues, which I think is going to strip it of some of its force and some of its potential to really fine-tune and tweak Australia's freedom of religion so that we can be a world leader.
What I would love to see is genuine bipartisanship and compromise, so this isn't a political issue, but just one we put to bed well. And that's what I fear that we've now lost the chance to having.
So in conclusion, Luke Beck, should organisations and families and individuals be free to hold and live by their own moral and religious values, especially when the majority might find those values immoral?
Yes, provided you're not hurting anybody else, absolutely.
And where is that line?
Well, that line, there are easy cases where if your religious beliefs require you to, for example, engage in, you know, physical harm to other people, well, then that's obviously not on the wrong side of the line. Then you get issues in the grey area where there is controversy, such as should the bakery be allowed to send away a gay couple because the baker has a religious objection to same-sex marriage and refused to make the gay wedding cake? My view on those sorts of issues is that if you operate in the marketplace and you open your business to the public, you should comply with all the ordinary public norms and anti-discrimination rules.
Robert Forsyth.
On the whole, I'm one with Luke on this, I think.
Really?
Surprisingly.
Well, then what about, say, the example of Qantas, Robert Forsyth, where the chief executive explained to his staff that the organisation has a very pro-same-sex marriage position?
I find that thing... I'm very frustrated by that kind of virtue behaviour by these companies, but it shouldn't be against the law. That's my point. They should, if they are to make fools of themselves or sniff the zeitgeist and think they can make money out of it, they should be free to do so.
But not hire and fire on that basis.
No, not hire and fire on that basis.
Renee Barker.
I think what's good for the goose has to be good for the gander in this situation. The moment people can be hired and fired, depending on which state they live in, on the basis of their religion. That shouldn't be permitted. But similarly, we should not permit religious organisations to discriminate beyond what is necessary for their religious beliefs. And if they have a religious belief that requires them to discriminate, and I say require, then that should be transparent.
Up next, we test great minds with Wits End the God Forbid quiz. Wits End! Yes, time for the quiz, and as always, we begin with the buzzers. Dr. Renee Barker, Anglican and lecturer in law at the University of Western Australia. Test your buzzer.
Objection. Story might contain evidence I don't like.
Sustained.
Okay, Luke Beck, atheist and associate professor of law at Monash University. Test your buzzer.
You want answers!
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Which just leaves the Right Reverend Robert Forsyth,
I'm dreading this.
Robert Forsyth, former Anglican Bishop of South Sydney. Why are you dreading this? Test your buzzer.
Happy Mardi Gras!
I knew it. That's why.
Okay, buzzers are working. Here we go. Which of the following religious refugees first sought freedom in the New World of America? Was it A, the Pilgrims, B, the Separatists, C, the Puritans, or D, the Huguenots?
Happy Mardi Gras!
Yeah, Robert?
The Huguenots.
You are quite correct. Most people think it was the Pilgrims or the Separatists, as they were known, who sailed for Plymouth, Massachusetts on the Mayflower in 1620. The Puritans came in 1629, but the French Huguenots, the Protestants, reached South Carolina and Florida as early as the 1560s. Perhaps the reason they're not as well remembered is because they were massacred soon after by the Spanish conquistadors. Next question. In the history of Australia, how many people have been successfully prosecuted for blasphemy?
You can't handle the truth!
By Australia, do you mean since 1901, or are you including the colonial period?
Including colonial period.
It would be something like three, I think.
According to my source, which is the Ruddock Review, funnily enough, the answer is just one. William Jones, guilty of blasphemous libel in Parramatta, New South Wales in 1871. Does anyone remember what he said that was blasphemous or what his punishment was?
No idea.
No idea, because he's not the famous one. There's a woman who was acquitted and it was much more interesting. She published a book on contraception and she was acquitted.
What did he say?
Well, William Jones was the man. He was elderly. He said the Old Testament was immoral and unsuitable for female readers. He was sentenced to 2 years jail, fined £100. This is 1871, but a public outcry at the time saw him released after just 4 weeks behind bars.
James, one of the good things we all three, I think, agree on completely is that the Ruddock Report wants to make sure that nothing like any blasphemy laws remain in any form.
Yes.
Noting, of course, that blasphemy remains a crime in some parts of Australia.
I know, but it should be removed.
It should be removed.
And the government has accepted that recommendation.
And does not propose to introduce any legislation to do so.
Including the Shipping Registration Regulations 1981, which I didn't realise forbid blasphemous ship names.
Yes. I was somewhat bemused to read that.
Rats, that's ruining my plans.
But Luke, that's the only federal law that applies to blasphemy, and it's encouraged the states to remove theirs, no? Yeah.
That's right, but the federal parliament could exercise its powers and override all the state laws if they wanted to, in the same way they exercise their powers to override the state laws that criminalised gay sex.
Oh, yeah, with the foreign affairs power.
That's right.
Follow-up question. In 1997, the then Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne, George Pell, unsuccessfully sought a Supreme Court injunction to prevent the National Gallery of Victoria from exhibiting what?
Objection. Story might contain evidence I don't like.
Sustained.
Piss Christ.
That's right. And I think he was wrong to do so, by the way.
That's quite right. The American artist Andre Serrano, a photograph of a crucifix submerged in a vat of the artist's own urine. Right. The judge ruling against the church, saying the law of blasphemous libel is an anachronism of English history.
Correct.
Question. The artist responsible for Piss Christ, Andre Serrano, what was his religion or was he non-religious?
Happy Mardi Gras.
Can I have a guess? Was he Catholic?
He was. And he said the crucifixion of Jesus was horrifically bloody. He was trying to interpret that with another form of
human... So it wasn't even intended to be blasphemous.
Perhaps not.
Well, there is something in that. The cross crucifixion of Jesus was regarded as an obscene and terrible event in its context. And many people thought it was something you don't talk about in polite society. So he's onto something.
Well, have a listen to this 2015 conversation between atheist Stephen Fry and Irish TV host Gay Byrne.
Suppose it's all true and you walk up to the pearly gates and you are confronted by God. What will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
I'd say, bone cancer in children? What's that about? Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain?
Stephen Fry, and that comment resulted in Irish police investigating Stephen Fry for blasphemy. The police initiated their investigation after receiving how many complaints? 1, 10, 100, or 1,000?
Objection, story might contain evidence I don't like.
Happy Mardi Gras!
One.
Yes, you're both right, just one, and under the terms of Ireland's blasphemy law, one complaint is not enough to prosecute, and the investigation was closed.
Interestingly, the Republic of Ireland recently voted in a referendum to get rid of its blasphemy laws from its constitution.
Yes, but that law remains on the books because it's a statute.
Exactly. They have two blasphemy laws. They had one in the constitution and one in the statute books.
Next question. In 1966, which famous musician said, "Christianity will go. It will vanish and shrink. We are more popular than Jesus now."
Happy Mardi Gras!
The late John Lennon.
Correct. John Lennon of the Beatles in America. That led to protests in which Beatles records and memorabilia were burnt. Imagine how much the memorabilia would be worth today. Though Lennon later explained that he meant all things in popular culture, not just the Beatles, are overtaking Christianity in terms of their mass appeal. Have a listen.
I wasn't saying the Beatles are better than Jesus or God or Christianity, but I could have said TV or cinema or anything else that's popular, or motor cars are bigger than Jesus.
By the way, that's not true. Religion is growing in the world. It may be it's declining in Western countries, but in other countries it's going gangbusters.
Yeah, turns out he was wrong.
Nice music, just bad ideas, that's all.
You can discuss it further in heaven when you meet him. Next question, Monty Python, the film The Life of Brian. A blasphemer is sentenced to death for saying what?
Happy Mardi Gras!
Jehovah.
Quite right.
Can I say that on radio?
Well, you tell me, you're the clergyman.
It is actually against the law. It was against the law in New Testament times to utter the divine name. Well, regard is so sacred, and that's a parody of that actual reality.
Complaints to GPO Box 9994 in your capital city. Let's listen to the Monty Python crime in action.
Mathias, son of Deuteronomy of Gath, you have been found guilty of uttering the name of our Lord. You are to be stoned to death. Look, I had a lovely supper, and all I said to my wife was that piece of halibut was good enough for Jehovah. He said it again!
Delicious halibut, but not delicious enough to blaspheme by taking the Lord's name in vain, as was done on The Life of Brian and by Reverend Robert Forsyth himself just a few moments ago. Final question. It seems every year there's a story, mostly false, about Christmas being banned because of political correctness gone mad. In fact, Christmas was banned by Christians in 1659. Where did this take place?
Happy Mardi Gras!
In Scotland, it was banned. It was also banned in Massachusetts by the Puritans. Christmas had a very patchy past in terms of Christians banning it.
You are, again, correct. The answer I have, America's Massachusetts Bay Colony. The Puritans believed Christmas had no biblical justification and the festival's possible pagan origins encouraged drunkenness and promiscuity. And with that, I think we probably have to declare Robert Forsyth the winner of the quiz.
My wife says I have a junk brain.
Walking Wikipedia. Thank you all three of you for your wonderful contribution on the panel today. Dr. Renee Barker, lecturer in law at the University of Western Australia. Check out her new book, State and Religion, The Australian Story. Renee, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Also, Associate Professor of Constitutional Law at Monash, Luke Beck, his book, Religious Freedom and the Australian Constitution. Luke, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And Reverend Robert Forsyth, formerly Anglican Bishop of South Sydney, now Senior Fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies. Thank you, Robert.
Thanks, James.
Don't forget you can subscribe to the God Forbid podcast on the ABC Listen app. Email me at godforbid@abc.net.au. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, remember to be good. God forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.